Good morning. My name's Ruth. I'm one of the pastors here, and I want to give you a warm welcome to our new series, Tension: Real Faith in a Real World. Through this series, we want to wrestle with how we can live as a community of hope and transformation in a world that can sometimes feel not terribly hopeful and not all that interested in being transformed either. How can we have real faith? How can we authentically, genuinely, passionately believe that God's love and justice will prevail when we live in a world in the state that it's in? And with us, if we're honest, in the state that we're in, can we really think that we can be the hope and for the change we want to see in the world when most of us, or maybe I'm just speaking for myself here, but for me, most of the time, I'm just trying to get through the day. How can we believe that God's love and justice will ultimately prevail when we listen to the news and there seems to be so much oppression and violence that goes unanswered? How can we take all these lofty things that we sing about, and we talk about at church, and apply that to our everyday lives, in our jobs, our homes, our neighborhoods? So we'll give obviously all the definitive answers to that over the next 4 weeks. No, we won't. But hopefully we'll chip away at a little bit of the tension that I think we all feel between our beliefs and what we long to be true, and at least to some degree believe to be true, and our everyday life of the reality of the world that we live in. And today's topic that we're going to chip at just a little bit is living with doubt and uncertainty. Humans, it seems, are drawn to certainty. From a psychological perspective, uncertainty is very stressful. Scientists say that when we look at something or we hear something, we're actually already anticipating what we're going to hear or see next. And when we can't do that, our body releases stress hormones. Tests show that on average, knowing something bad is definitely going to happen is way less stressful than knowing there's a 50-50 chance. Now, obviously, that doesn't apply to everything, but in general, we just want to know. And there's good evolutionary reasons for this. If we're not sure what's lying in the grass, if it's a broken branch or it's a snake, we'd better be prepared for the worst, right? And the stress hormones released through uncertainty prepare our body for fight or flight. So in some situations, it's a really useful response. But we face all kinds of uncertainty in our life, and that can be stressful. It can cause anxiety. It can lead to a tendency to assume the worst. It can give us tunnel vision so that we don't have perspective. And often we begin to make all kinds of assumptions and connections that may or may not be correct as we attempt to return to a place of increased certainty where we feel safer and more in control and less stressed. And this very human natural longing for certainty is often reflected in our approach to religion. We want to know, to be sure. It feels good, feels safe. And I think that's probably part of the reason we don't talk about doubt generally in churches all that much, other than to condemn it or to deny it. Doubt is often seen as a bad thing, as an impediment to faith, or the enemy of faith. Even a sign that we lack spiritual development. We might even feel guilty for having doubts. I really hope that's not true for any of us here. At Cedar Ridge, we often talk about embracing and welcoming doubts, and we aim to be a safe place to express doubt. And I think many of us from talking to people are actually okay with general doubts. But I think when we hear expressions of specific doubts, it can still make us very nervous. But if we're honest, we all have doubts. The author Frederick Buechner wrote, "Whether your faith is that there is a God or that there is not a God, if you don't have any doubts, you are either kidding yourself or asleep." So we're going to put that to the test now. We're going to do a poll. Which is making me a bit anxious because I don't know what's going to happen in this poll. But if you could take out your phone, please. And if you can just take a photo of this QR code, and it's going to take you to a Google form to answer five very, very brief questions. This poll, I promise you, is 100% anonymous, completely anonymous. No one's going to know your answers. So be as honest as you like. And there's no right answers, right? I think we all have doubts, but these may or may not be areas where you have doubts. So there's no right answers. One is never, five is always, and we'll give 1 minute to answer these questions. I'm going to sit. Super. Yeah, we good? All right. Okay. So do we have some results then, Greg? Can we see the results? I cannot see the results. Not the glass. Okay. So I doubt the Bible is historically accurate. So we've got a couple of people that never doubt that. But most of us, it seems, at least have some or often or always doubt that. Okay, next one. I doubt prayer accomplishes anything. So we've got, again, at least sometimes we've got quite a lot of doubt. Next one. I doubt love and justice will ultimately prevail. Again, a lot in the middle there. At least sometimes we doubt. I doubt God is trustworthy. So less often, but still some doubt there. And I doubt there is a God. So a lot of us don't doubt that, but some, again, still do have doubt that. All right, thank you for indulging me. So we all, or most of us, I should say, most of us have got doubts about some pretty fundamental things, at least sometimes. But generally, we don't like to talk about it. And partly, as we mentioned, it's because being certain or feeling that you're certain feels good, and uncertainty is stressful. But in addition, our faith is something that is really important to us. That's why we're here, right? I mean, it's something that's deeply held. It's very personal. It's part of who we are. So to start questioning that can feel kind of personally threatening. Some of us probably also worry that if we start questioning one thing, like we could be on a slippery slope. Where's it all going to end? We could end up unraveling our faith, and then maybe we'd have nothing left. That can be scary. I think we also sometimes are more comfortable with our own doubts, us having doubts, than with other people having doubts. Because what if people doubt something that feels very precious and very true to me? Is that going to start undermining my faith? Or what, on the converse, if we all are doubting the same things? What if we're all fooling ourselves? I think we want at least some people to be sure. People we respect, maybe people in authority, because then they can guide us, they can reassure us and keep the faith that we'd like to have, although we struggle with it. Goethe famously quipped, "Tell me of your certainties. I have doubts enough of my own." And perhaps we relate to that. Perhaps we think church should be a place where we are reassured with certainty. This is what you should believe. This is what's true. This is what's going to happen. If you do these things, then you'll be fine. There's safety, there's comfort in that kind of an approach. I think some of us too have probably been taught that doubt is a sin, that it's the opposite of faith. Faith for many people is synonymous with being certain, knowing exactly what you believe and not questioning it or wavering at all. Strong faith is being sure that you are right, the corollary of which is presumably that anyone who disagrees with you is wrong. And some verses of scripture taken in isolation have helped the church to kind of justify this view of faith as being all about knowing without doubt, being certain without questioning. For example, there's a well-known definition of faith in the book of Hebrews in chapter 11. In the New International Version, which many of us use, it reads, "Now faith is confidence in what we hope for and assurance about what we do not see." Confidence and assurance sounds pretty certain. But other versions give a more accurate translation of the Greek in saying, "Now faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen." Faith is not mental certainty so much as it is something that gives substance, gives shape to hope. It makes hope come alive in our imagination such that we're enabled to envision a new reality. It provides evidence that a thing is possible because we can envision it, and therefore we can work towards it. We can pray and we can act as we move towards that thing that we can see. It's the opposite, I think, of despair, which refuses to see anything other than what is right now. There are no other possibilities. Or cynical resignation that says, as things are now, they're always going to be. There's no point in even trying. There's nothing we can do. Faith brings other possibilities to life. And Hebrews chapter 11 then goes on to name a whole bunch of people from the Jewish scripture who are models of faith. People like Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and Moses, David, Gideon, a whole bunch of people. People who had lots of doubts, people who demanded proof and tried to run away from God and asked lots of questions and argued with God, people who messed up time and time again. These are the models of faith. Biblical faith is not certainty. It's not an absence of doubt. It's not even unquestioning obedience. Faith, according to the writer of Hebrews, is all about engaging with God and wrestling with God and not giving up on God, no matter what happens. And this idea of wrestling with God comes from the story of Jacob way back in the book of Genesis. Jacob was not a very likable fellow, I don't think. He cheated his twin brother out of his inheritance and then had to flee for his life because his brother Esau was so mad. Then he settled in another country and got married. He got cheated along the way, but he ended up cheating his uncle in order to become very wealthy and then again had to flee for his life. Jacob believed that through all of this, God had made him prosperous. After all, he'd got a large family, he'd got lots of livestock, and that God was now directing him to go back to his homeland. And although many years had passed, he didn't know whether or not Esau was still wanting to kill him. And so he had a lot of concern. And we see in Jacob's response to this situation a mixture of faith and doubt. We read in Genesis 32, Jacob prayed, "O God of my father Abraham, God of my father Isaac, Lord, you who said to me, 'Go back to your country and your relatives, and I will make you prosper.' I am unworthy of all the kindness and faithfulness you have shown your servant. I had only my staff when I crossed this Jordan, but now I have become two camps. Save me, I pray, from the hand of my brother Esau, for I'm afraid he will come and attack me and also the mothers with their children. But you have said, 'I will surely make you prosper and will make your descendants like the sand of the sea, which cannot be counted.'" So on one hand, Jacob had faith that God would help him and prosper him. On the other hand, he's got doubts because he thought Esau wanted him dead. And Jacob took defensive measures. He split his tribe into two different groups so that if one was attacked, the other group could hopefully escape. And he sent them over the river. And then he was all alone. And we read that he wrestled all night with a man whom Jacob identified as God, or at least very closely associated with God. He says he has the face of God. And at the end of this epic struggle, this mysterious figure that Jacob has been wrestling with says, "Let me go." And Jacob replies, "Not until you bless me." And we read, "Then the man said, 'Your name will no longer be Jacob, but Israel,'" which means he struggles with God, "because you have struggled with God and with humans and have overcome." Jacob said, "Please tell me your name." But he replied, "Why do you ask my name?" And then he blessed him there. So Jacob called the place Peniel, which means face of God, saying, "It is because I saw God face to face, and yet my life was spared." Now, this is an odd story if you take it literally, but I think from a figurative sense, we can perhaps relate to it. Jacob was someone who was quick to rely on his own cunning to get exactly what he wanted. And he was quick to run away when he got caught out. But here, for once in his life, he stops running. And he thinks about facing up to what he's done and the potential cost of doing that. And he calls out to God, to the God of his father and the God of his grandfather for help, the God of his ancestors, the God that he's been taught to believe in, but doesn't yet seem to have that much of a personal connection with. And he struggles all night until in the morning there's some kind of a breakthrough. And he senses he's not the same as he was. He's not the same person anymore because he has met God for himself and now he's blessed. This is the Hebrew understanding of faith. It's about struggling with and wrestling with and arguing with God in order to know God for ourselves. And we're invited to do that with authenticity and with honesty. Job is another example of this kind of faith in perhaps the oldest of the Jewish scriptures. You might remember that story of Job. He seemed to live a very good life, and yet a whole load of disaster falls on him, and he says this: "My complaint is bitter. God's hand is heavy in spite of my groaning. If only I knew where to find God, if only I could go to his dwelling, I would state my case before him and fill my mouth with arguments. But if I go to the east, he's not there. If I go to the west, I do not find him." Job feels abandoned by God. Where is God when everything in his life falls apart? Job doubts the goodness of God, the justice of God. Life is not fair, and he wants to go and argue his case. And yet Job is a model of faith because he's honest with God, and he takes his complaints directly to God. He doesn't give up on God. He keeps arguing. He keeps calling out. He keeps asking those hard questions, even though for 37 long chapters, God doesn't say a word. Job gets no answers. He doesn't sense God's presence, but he keeps calling out. He keeps arguing. He keeps speaking to God. And ultimately, Job does experience God's presence. He really still doesn't get an answer, but he knows that God is with him, and God commends Job for his honesty and for his faithful persistence. And we see the same thing throughout the Psalms, where one songwriter after another expresses deep faith in God's love and provision and care in one verse. And then in the very next verse, asks, is God even there? Does God care at all about what's going on? Is God ever going to bring about justice? Biblical faith is not neat and tidy. It's absolutely nothing to believe, I mean, to do with believing a set of orderly statements of theologies. That's not what faith is. It's messy. It's relational. It's hoping in God and being disappointed with God. It's believing that God is with us always and simultaneously asking, where is God? Where is God in this? It's trusting that God cares for the poor and the oppressed, while watching injustice prevail and crying out in anger and heartbreak at a God who seems inexplicitly absent. Biblical faith doesn't mean accepting all that happens in our broken world with religious platitudes about, well, it'll all be fine one day. It's rather about living in the present and engaging our minds and our hearts, being honest with God about our questions and our doubts. Doubts are not antithetical to faith. And faith is not the absence of doubt. Rather, Buechner puts it, faith is a decision to believe in the midst of doubt. Making room for doubt allows us to be honest and authentic. It can also enable us to be humble, to admit that we don't have all the answers, that God is so much bigger than us and so much more than our limited thinking can ever hope to contain. And there's just so much we don't know, so much that we think we know that we probably are wrong about. As the prophet Isaiah wrote, "For my thoughts are not your thoughts, neither are your ways my ways, declares the Lord. As the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts." The Latin root of doubt is dubitare, which means to hesitate, to pause and think rather than to rush forward. Doubt gives us room to ask questions and to really search for truth, to listen to others who don't think like us, to learn from people, to have empathy, curiosity, creativity, things that you really can't afford to engage in if your sole focus is maintaining the comfort of certainty. Some people who claim to have no doubts can be pretty scary, I think, because certainty about being right can justify all kinds of intolerance. I don't think it has to, but it has that potential. You can feel superior, and that can be manifested in unloving responses to people with whom you disagree. If you are sure, absolutely sure, that you are right, then your enemies are presumably God's enemies. Right? And then the ends can start to justify the means. And we have centuries of religious violence and oppression to show just how ugly that can all get. Doubt can make space for humility and for learning. So although uncertainty is uncomfortable, I'd advocate for not being too quick to rush through doubts and to fix them and to land on answers, but rather to sit with them and consider them carefully. Having said that, I think there are some less healthy paths that doubt can lead us down, such as agnosticism. Agnosticism is being sure that we can't be sure of anything beyond the material world. It's a return to certainty, but of a negative kind. Whereas doubt opens up space to ask questions and to search for truth, agnosticism closes that down again by saying, well, no one knows, no one can know, there's no point in even trying. Neither is doubt the same as willful unbelief, by which I mean the refusal to believe. Whereas doubt hesitates, it pauses and thinks and questions and wrestles with God, unbelief refuses to do that. For whatever reason, often because someone's been very hurt, unbelief rejects God and walks away. It refuses to engage. Similarly with apathy. Apathy can't be bothered to wrestle and struggle, to think through and to ask those hard questions, doesn't care enough. It doesn't think it matters all that much. I also think, although I'm not certain, obviously, that healthy doubt does not mean perpetual deconstruction. Deconstruction has become a bit of a trendy word for kind of thinking through what it is you believe and getting rid of beliefs that are no longer healthy or make sense to you you believe are true anymore or not loving anymore. And I think there's a lot of value in that process. It's a journey a lot of us have been on or continue to be on. It's part of that process of asking really hard questions about what it is we believe and wrestling with God to know God better. But there comes a point, I think, when you hit bedrock and you can start to rebuild slowly, lightly, with humility. And I say this because I'm going to get personal for a moment. I have all kinds of doubt. And a lot of that is down to my personality. I'm naturally very analytical and very rational. I like order and internal consistency. I'm naturally very skeptical. Some would say argumentative, although I'd argue with that. I wouldn't actually. I say it's true. I love theology. I love theology books. But the worst books in the world for me are Christian apologetics, books that try and prove Christian truths. Because I'm so argumentative that even if I completely agree with the point the author's making, I will, you know, because he's, and it's nearly always a he, let's face it, is insisting that it's true, I will decide that it's not, you know, because that's me. I'm also older than I was, as we all are. I'm about 50 years into my faith journey. And with each passing year, I think there are fewer and fewer things I would say I know to be true. You really should have met me when I was 20. Got it all worked out back then. Now, not so much. I used to have a lot of strong stances on all kinds of theological debates that I'm much less confident about now. So in addition to being naturally skeptical and old enough to know that there's a whole lot I don't know, I also struggle with depression. And I've talked about this many times before, but when I am depressed, I doubt all kinds of things. I doubt that justice will prevail. I doubt that there's any point to life. I doubt that I'm loved. I doubt that I'm worth being loved. But one thing, and I didn't tell you about this before, Ben, so sorry. But one thing I've chosen not to doubt is that my wonderful husband loves me. Now, mainly that's because he's given me tons of evidence for that, that he does love me even in the darkest moments. But I also choose to believe that because I need to believe it to get through those times. And I know that what feels true at a given moment when I'm depressed will not necessarily feel true at a later date. So for me, that's bedrock. That's where I choose to stop digging, stop questioning and doubting. Similarly, when the world seems just such a mess and I feel overwhelmed by that, or when something happens to someone that I really love, I may start to doubt all kinds of things about God. But my bedrock, my firm foundation that I choose to believe, even when I don't feel it in that moment, is that for me, life with Jesus is worth so much more than life without Jesus. That whatever doubts or questions I have, I'm determined to struggle through them with Jesus and not without. That's my bedrock. I'm not saying that should be yours. It's experiential. It's relational. It's not theological. I can't give you an argument for that. It's a person I trust rather than a set of theological beliefs. But that for me is my bedrock. And at some point, faith is a choice. And in making that choice, we need to ask ourselves, what do I want to believe? Because we all have a tendency to end up believing what we want to believe. The philosopher Thomas Nagel wrote, "I want atheism to be true. It isn't just that I don't believe in God. I don't want there to be a God. I don't want the universe to be like that. Despite all my doubts sometimes, I want God to be love. And I want love to conquer all hatred and fear. And I want to be part of that." I know I've shared this before, but this cartoon, I think, really sums up how I feel about my faith in times of doubt. This is someone, if you can't read it, someone at a climate change summit asking, "What if it's all a big hoax and we end up creating a better world for nothing?" Thomas is one of my favorite characters in the Christian scriptures. I really admire his commitment to Jesus, but I also relate to his sunny, carefree outlook on life. In John chapter 11, for example, Jesus says he needs to go back to Judea, where he's faced a lot of opposition. And we read, "Then Thomas, also known as Didymus, said to the rest of the disciples, 'Let us also go that we may die with him.'" Not exactly an optimist, but committed. He still wanted to go. We often refer to him, of course, as Doubting Thomas, because as you may remember, after Jesus was resurrected from the dead, after he'd been crucified, the other disciples would gather together and they met the resurrected Jesus, but Thomas wasn't there. And when they told Thomas, all excited, he initially refused to believe. He said, "Now Thomas, also known as Didymus, one of the 12, was not with the disciples when Jesus came. So the other disciples told him, 'We have seen the Lord.' But he said to them, 'Unless I see the nail marks in his hands and put my finger where the nails were and put my hand into his side, I will not believe.'" Thomas is a hardcore skeptic. I mean, the "unless I see" bit, I get that. But "unless I put my hand into his side, I will not believe." Why would someone even say that? Well, I don't think that, well, perhaps this is not so much meant to be a literal desire to put his hand in his side, which would be pretty gross, as it is that he wants to have the full experience, to be actually part of what the other disciples are telling him has happened. If this is true, if, and that is a huge if for Thomas, if it's true, he doesn't just want to view this from a distance, but to be right there, as close as it's possible to be. Then he'll believe. He'll really believe. And then, of course, Jesus appears to the disciples when Thomas is there and tells Thomas, "Go ahead, touch away. Stop doubting and believe." And Thomas, Doubting Thomas, makes this incredible statement of faith. He addresses Jesus, whom he'd known for 3 years, who he'd lived with for 3 years, someone he's seen get tired and sweaty and be hungry and get blisters and who knows what else. A person he knows to be fully human, he calls him "my Lord and my God." Such an amazing statement of faith. Thomas and his other name, Didymus, both mean twin. Now, it's unlikely that was his actual name, but rather a nickname. And he could have been a biological twin, or maybe he just looked like someone else, and so that was his nickname. But the early theologians in the church made the point that we are all twins like Thomas. We all have the potential for incredible faith and so much doubt. And it's by staying in community that we help our faith twin to become more dominant. It's through being honest with one another, through supporting and encouraging one another, that we're able to choose faith in the midst of doubt. Jude is a brief letter towards the end of the Bible, and it has this short verse in it. It says, "Be merciful to those who doubt." Other translations have "show compassion" or "be kind to those who are doubting." We're not told to judge one another, but to be kind. In Hebrews, a book that has so much to say about faith, we read, "Let us hold unswervingly to the hope we profess, for he who promised is faithful. And let us consider how we may spur one another on towards love and good deeds, not giving up meeting together as some are in the habit of doing, but encouraging one another." We can have hope, not because we've figured it all out, we've got the answers, we haven't, but because God is faithful. And we can share that hope with one another, encouraging one another and spurring each other on. What, to have better theology? No, to love and good deeds. We're going to take communion now, if the band would like to come back. And one of the things I love most about communion is just how non-prescriptive it is. Jesus didn't give a long lecture on its theological significance and what it does and how we should think about it and what it accomplishes exactly and where and how and all of that we should take it. He simply took bread and gave thanks and broke it and gave it to his friends and said, "This is my body. Do this in remembrance of me." And in the same way, took the cup and gave it to them and said, "This is my blood. Drink it in remembrance of me." And amazingly, even Judas, who had agreed to betray Jesus, certainly not a man of faith, was invited to eat and drink. This gift of love that's represented in communion is so inclusive. It's open to all, no matter how great or how small your faith, no matter what you doubt, how much you doubt, you are loved, you are welcome, you are invited to be part of this community. Also, during this time, we have other ways to respond. You might like to light a candle at the back as a symbol of faith and hope. You might want to write out a prayer. You can write it at the stations, or you might want to pray with someone at the back. You might want to make a gift or just sit and sing. So however you want to respond is fine. But before we do that, let's just take a few moments of silence to be honest with God about our doubts, questions, our struggles. God knows. So let's just be honest for a moment with God. God, you know that we are a jumble of faith and doubt, questions. Help us to choose to trust you. Help us to find the energy to struggle with you, to cry out to you no matter what we're facing. Help us to stick with you, for you have the words of eternal life. Amen.